This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests have described Pakistan as the epicenter of terror, a disingenuous regime with its hands on the nuclear tiller. That was their assessment before the current crisis. Now the situation is more dire. A country with nuclear weapons and a sizable population of Islamic extremists has a president who has suspended the constitution to remain in power. President Musharraf has put the opposition leader, Benazir Bhutto, under house arrest for the second time. Today, she called for him to step down. My guests, Adrian Levy and Catherine Scott Clark, are investigative journalists with the British newspaper The Guardian. They've written a new book about Pakistan, how it developed nuclear weapons, and how it helped North Korea and Iran develop nuclear programs. The book is called Deception: Pakistan, the United States, and the Secret Trade in Nuclear Weapons. The authors say for three decades, U.S. administrations, Republican and Democrat, as well as governments in Britain and other European countries, have allowed Pakistan to acquire nuclear technology and disguised how Pakistan sold it. Adrian Levy, Catherine Scott Clark, welcome to Fresh Air. As you say in your book, Washington's nightmare is a nuclear Pakistan controlled by fundamentalists. What do you think the odds are that Musharraf might be overthrown by fundamentalists?
Well, I say everything at the moment is up in the air, in the sense that the country is unraveling before our eyes. We have the suspension of the Constitution and the National Assembly. We have seen the streets alive with protesters, the radicalization of those protesters. But I think the chances of Musharraf falling to some kind of Islamist coup are zero. I think this is very much a line that's being delivered by certain elements within the Pentagon who are propping up the Musharraf regime.
Wait, so are you saying that you think the Bush administration is playing up fears of an Islamist coup to justify what Musharraf is doing?
I think to justify the fact that Washington has given $10 billion since 9/11 to Musharraf in exchange for his promise to fight with the West on the war on terror, something that he really hasn't kind of followed through on. I mean, all the promises he made after 9/11 to cut back on madrasas, religious schools, and to clip the wings of the radical groups operating out of Pakistan, none of these things have actually happened. So I think partially to save face, and also there is no long-term alternative as far as Washington is concerned. I mean, everything has been put into the Musharraf basket, and I think even a State Department spokesman said a few days ago that having spent so much money on Musharraf, it was like giving too much of a loan from a bank you couldn't just pull out.
How many estimated nuclear weapons does Pakistan have, and what are your concerns about the possibility of a weapon or weapons getting into hands outside of the official government in Pakistan during this chaotic period?
It's very difficult to say exactly how many weapons nuclear weapons Pakistan has, because they're not part of the International Atomic Energy Agency. They haven't signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty. So there is no access for international monitors to go into Pakistan and inspect their weapons facilities. But the best guesstimate is somewhere between 40 and 70 assembled warheads. I think the problem, the real problem, is not a nuclear warhead getting into the wrong hands. I think that's relatively unlikely, according to most Western experts. But the problem is fissile material in Pakistan, of which there is a lot that is unsecured. When we were researching our book, we spoke to people very close to A.Q. Khan, the so-called father of the Islamic bomb, and they said that the laboratories at Kahuta, which is the weapons base outside Islamabad, there were something like 40 canisters of highly enriched uranium gas which had gone missing in 2004-2005. And, I mean, that is a vast amount of fissile material, and it hasn't been found. And if you think that you only need something like 100 grams of metallized fissile material to make a dirty bomb, then there's a lot of material potentially out there, and there are no answers coming back from Pakistan about where it's actually gone.
Not only that, but scientists within the establishment have become increasingly radicalized, and already two were found to have reached out to Al-Qaeda elements in Afghanistan in 2002.
AQ Khan, who's the father of Pakistan's nuclear bomb and the single person responsible for the most nuclear proliferation, to countries like North Korea and Iran, is under house arrest. But you say that there's evidence that Pakistan has continued to sell nuclear technology under Musharraf during AQ Khan's house arrest. What is the evidence?
There's several pieces of evidence that appears to show that the proliferation never stopped, even though AQ Khan held his hands up in 2004 in a now notorious live television interview, claiming sole responsibility for the racket, him and a group of scientists. However, a very widespread intelligence gathering project run by agencies in the West, post this 2004 confession by Khan, showed that Pakistan was continuing to procure vast numbers of dual-use components for its nuclear program, far more than any one country could need for itself, leading the intelligence agents to conclude that they were procuring to sell to other agents. Not only that, but an operation by US Justice uncovered post-2004 again, a company in Islamabad working for the Pakistan military that was buying, through South Africa, US-supplied nuclear triggers, an event that was taking place well past AQ Khan's mea culpa.
If this nuclear technology is being sold, is it being sold with the blessing of Musharraf or behind his back?
With the blessing of Musharraf and the Pakistan military, who have always been in charge of the nuclear program, and from the evidence that we gathered inside Pakistan and outside Pakistan from the US and intelligence services in Europe, it's quite clear that the military was running the proliferation racket right from the moment that it began in roughly in 1990, when the then head of the army, a general called Mirza Aslan Beg, he actually said to the US ambassador and to General Norman Schwarzkopf, who was then head of CENTCOM, and to a Pentagon official, "You're about to cut us off because the Soviet war in Afghanistan has ended and our US gravy train of aid over the past 10 years is about to finish, and we're going to be broke, and we're going to sell the only thing that we have that's worth any money, which is our nuclear technology, and our first customer is going to be Iran." And those messages were reported back to Washington by those three US officials, and yet nothing was done, and Pakistan was cut off. And that was the beginning of the proliferation racket, which was controlled by the Pakistan military from that point up until the present day.
And we'll get to Iran a little bit later. This would be a good point to mention that a Foreign Office spokesperson from Pakistan described the allegations in your book as a pack of lies and said that some people cannot digest our nuclear capability and are involved in negative propaganda, but Pakistan is an anchor of peace and stability in the region. So I just want to mention that. My guests are Adrian Levy and Catherine Scott Clark. They're the authors of the new book, Deception, Pakistan, the United States, and the Secret Trade in Nuclear Weapons, and their senior correspondents with the British newspaper, The Guardian. As you said, A.Q. Khan, who is the father of Pakistan's nuclear bomb and then became the chief renegade proliferator, you know, in black market nuclear weapons technology, made this 2004 public confession on Pakistan television saying that he was the person responsible for this, and then he was put under house arrest. Job done. But you say that that TV confession was actually part of a plan that was cooked up by Musharraf and by Richard Armitage, who was then Deputy Secretary of State. What did you learn about this?
After talking to many people within the U.S. State Department and within the Pakistan military and those close to AQ Khan, it became clear that there was a concerted effort to recalibrate, to recharacterize the proliferation of the Pakistan military as the crime of an individual. And the thinking behind this was that Pakistan in 2001, the end of 2001 and beginning of 2002, had obviously signed up to the war on terror, and the Pakistan military were being presented as a key ally in helping to track down the remnants of the Taliban and to close up al-Qaeda. However, the proliferation, the deal, if you like, that was put on the table was that the proliferation would stop, that the efforts made by the Pakistan military would increase, that we would see some positive intelligence feeding back about about both the closure of the proliferation activities and also who, which individuals and nation states had been reached out to by the military. And yet we reached this extraordinary situation where by 2006, President Musharraf tells the West that his investigations are over, he discovered nothing, the proliferation was shut down. And everyone we know on the US and British side said to us, we asked questions, we repeatedly asked questions, and yet we received pretty much zero intelligence back.
If I could just add to that, I mean, we spoke to a lot of the scientists who worked with Khan, who had been blamed as being part of this this racket, and they were really very shocked. I mean, they were in a state of shock in early 2004 when they were all being taken into custody, because they said they'd just been doing their jobs for the whole of their careers. They'd done what the military had asked them to do. They'd put the bomb together, and then when the military had asked them to sell it on, they had sold it on. And there was one aide to AQ Khan in particular who characterised for us what it was like to physically bring materials in and out of the lab. And he said there were so many responsible authorities who needed to be informed on a daily, hourly basis what was coming in and out of the Kahuta laboratories, that he spent most of his time filling in paperwork for the intelligence services, for the military, for various other agencies, the military intelligence. So the idea that there was this kind of these secret transports coming out of the labs and being sent off on secret planes to Dubai or to Tripoli or to Tehran was ridiculous, was ludicrous, because the military knew at every stage. And in fact, most of the materials that Khan supposedly single-handedly supplied to Gaddafi or to the Iranians went out on Pakistan International Airlines or on Pakistan military transport planes. But yes, I mean, there were US officials also who were saying very much that all the evidence was pointing to this being a military-run program and that the scientists were doing the military's bidding.
Okay, so as we said before, you say that Musharraf and Richard Armitage, who was then a deputy secretary of state in the Bush administration, cooked up this drama for AQ Khan to confess that he was the head of this black market nuclear network, and then he was being put under house arrest. So it would look like that was taken care of, and now we could just, like, back Musharraf and not worry anymore about nuclear proliferation coming from Pakistan. Did you talk to Richard Armitage? What does he have to say about this? Does he agree? Does he say that this happened, or is he denying that this happened?
He didn't want to talk about it. He absolutely didn't. But we talked to lots of other people in the State Department who were around him who gave corroborative information as to this being the plan of the White House. I mean, you're portraying this as an Armitage plan, but actually this is very much the thinking. He is carrying out the bidding of a White House strategy. And that strategy was at all costs to keep stability in Pakistan. And, of course, that in itself is not a bad idea if there was a quid pro quo. And yet, you know, the quid pro quo was that we would get access, the West would get access to the critical intelligence on proliferation, that the proliferation itself would cease, and that Pakistan would de-radicalize. And, of course, on all three levels, we received nothing.
So do you think that Pakistan is still proliferating, and that it's still selling nuclear technology?
There is evidence that Pakistan is procuring for its program more than it needs, leading those people who gather that evidence to conclude that they are buying to sell. We know that part of the network run by the military is still up and running from this investigation into an Islamabad company that tried to buy nuclear triggers from the United States post-2004. We know that they are selling proscribed metals and electrical equipment that they are prohibited from buying from the United States and from Europe, but are themselves exporting. So this picture tends to suggest that the country is still making money out of its nuclear network.
Now, when you say that the Pakistan military was selling nuclear technology to countries like North Korea, Iran, where was the money going? The money goes back to the government, to the military, to the scientists? Like, if you were following the money there, what would it tell you?
Well, there's a very interesting thing with Pakistan. It doesn't operate like a normal country in the sense that it has a civilian cabinet and it has the military. But the military actually are a class, an opaque class of their own. So regarding all military funding, the civilian politicians have no access to that information. It's impossible to know, for example, the precise budgets for the Pakistan military. And they don't even sit in on the cabinet-level discussions. The Pakistan military has direct access to cash as and when it needs it, and its accounts are not regulated by the civilian government. There are no sets of books there kept to an international standard which could be viewed either internally or externally. So in terms of the generation of capital, we can only speculate through whatever documents have been recovered along the way. I mean, we know, for example, that they made an offer, an extraordinary offer, to Saddam Hussein to sell a completed bomb. And we know this through documents recovered by weapons inspectors in 1995. And they were looking at hundreds of millions of dollars from Saddam for that one trade. We also know from Iran some of the amounts that are involved in the menu of items offered the Iranians, again, hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. So from this, we can extrapolate a rough idea of what they were trying to make. But following the money forensically, as one could probably in the UK or the US, in this case, is out of the question.
If I could just characterise just one particular sale, which might go some way to explaining the kind of the difference between the military and the civilian governments of Pakistan. We sat down with Benazir Bhutto to ask her about the North Korea sale of technology, which has been hotly debated about for many, many years. This happened in 1993 in December when she was Prime Minister for the second time. And she described how she was approached just before she was going on a trip to China by AQ Khan, who came to see her in Prime Minister's Secretariat with several military aides with him. And he said, look, you're going to China. It's only a short hop over to Pyongyang, to North Korea, and we'd really like you to go to North Korea to ask the president there if we can have access to his Nodong missile technology. We'd like some blueprints, basically. And she said she was concerned about doing this because she knew nothing about the military side of things. She was worried about the ramifications because this missile technology would be used potentially against India. And she was in the middle of negotiating with the Indians to kind of cease such hostile relations. But eventually she agreed to do it, and she went to North Korea and she had her sit-down banquet with the president, and over steam fish and water chestnuts she wrangled over how to introduce this subject, and eventually just came out with it and said that we'd like to buy your missile technology. But she explained to us she had no idea of how that was going to be paid for. She assumed it would be with cash, and she came back from Pyongyang to Islamabad with her handbag, now famously full of blueprints, and she handed them over to the military. And Khan said, thank you very much. And the army chief at the time came to her and said, look, we've put this particular general in charge of the project and we thank you for your contribution. But that was the end of her involvement. She never got to find out how it was paid for. She claims she never was told that the payment would be made in enrichment technology rather than cash, because Pakistan had no cash at that time. But I think we have to remember that the civilian governments through the 1990s, which was the greatest period of proliferation for Pakistan, knew very little about the people who were really running the country, which was the military, which is a similar scenario which we're facing today.
How much do you think the Bush administration knew about what you describe as the government and the military's complicity in the underground sales of nuclear technology?
I think they knew pretty much the lengths and breadths of the operation. When I say I think I knew, I mean, this is not based on my opinion at all. It's based on the opinion of people who are running or working within non-proliferation, working within the intelligence agencies, both in the US and very much in Europe. And what they describe is a vast dossier which showed how the military was continuing to reach out. And in particular of concern at that time, when Bush came to power, was North Korea, Libya, and China, which had been helping Pakistan to arm and to proliferate, to sell onwards. In fact, so detailed was the information that they had, of course, by this stage, the entire floor plans for all of the nuclear facilities. They knew what the Pakistan bomb looked like, and they had models for it, and they knew very much the trading routes used by the Pakistan military to sell on. In fact, the CIA had penetrated partially part of the Khan network, turning one of the key European suppliers, who was passing information back about who, where, what, why, and when. And this would, come together in a vast dossier presented to the White House. So it was quite clear in 2001 that one could say there was a military clique connected to Al-Qaeda with connections to the Taliban that had also been a rogue proliferator. But, of course, that wasn't Iraq. It was, according to the intelligence, Pakistan.
And we mustn't also forget that Pakistan was on the verge of being declared a terrorist state before 9/11. The head of the intelligence services, General Mahmoud Ahmed, was brought over to Washington very shortly before the World Trade Center attacks, and he was warned that that was what his country was about to be declared by the Bush government. And then immediately after 9/11, obviously, the world changed and history began again.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with investigative journalists Adrian Levy and Catherine Scott Clark, their senior correspondents for the British newspaper The Guardian. Their new book, Deception, is about how Pakistan managed to develop nuclear weapons in spite of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and the efforts of the International Atomic Energy Agency, the IAEA. The authors say the U.S. allowed Pakistan to acquire nuclear technology and disguised how Pakistan sold it to countries like North Korea and Iran. You say that consecutive U.S. administrations, Republican and Democrat, dating back to Jimmy Carter, enabled Pakistan to arm the axis of evil powers. You say the U.S. and Europe secretly allowed Pakistan to get the bomb and develop a stockpile of weapons technology. They then turned their backs on Pakistan as it began to sell it. How do you think that the U.S. and Europe helped Pakistan get the bomb?
The critical year is 1979, when the Shah of Iran fled and Khomeini returned to Tehran, and the US lost its primary listening stations in the Middle East and its primary ally in the Middle East. And then just a few months later, the Soviets marched into Kabul in Afghanistan. And that December, Zbigniew Brzezinski, the National Security Advisor to Carter, wrote a classified memo in which he said he advised that the gold standard of non-proliferation that Carter had upheld until that point would have to take a back seat if the US was going to counter the threat of the Soviets in Afghanistan, because the closest and necessary buffer state and ally would have to be Pakistan, and that Pakistan was already seeking a bomb. Carter ran out of steam, but within 2 weeks of Reagan coming into the White House, a deal had been done with Islamabad, and from that point throughout the 1980s, billions flowed from Washington to Islamabad for the Soviet war, but millions of that aid money went sideways, redirected by the Pakistani authorities into their nuclear program. The US also supplied components through the Pentagon to the Pakistan nuclear labs. These are components which have been banned by the US Commerce Department for sale, but that the Pentagon felt was necessary to ease their relationship military man to allow these components to go through.
But there's another element to this as well. Obviously, Reagan, throughout both administrations, is forced, in order for foreign aid to be released to Pakistan, to lubricate the relationship with Pakistan assisting the US to oust the Soviets from Afghanistan. Reagan has to certify every year that Pakistan has no bomb and is not seeking a weapon. And so you'd have this process of annual certification while officials working for the administration were going out to Pakistan and saying precisely the opposite. So Al Haig was the first then Secretary of State. He met with the number two, General Arif, and said, we can live with a Pakistan bomb. I mean, we documented a whole series of conversations whereby the message would be delivered that America would turn a blind eye. And yet, as Kathy's described, that blind eye actually then became something far worse, which was concrete aid being delivered by the Pentagon.
It's been reported that the Bush administration has drawn up a plan for attacking Iran, attacking some of Iran's nuclear development sites. How serious the Bush administration is of actually carrying through on those plans is completely unclear. What role do you think Pakistan played in helping Iran go nuclear?
Well, we know through declarations made by the Iranians themselves to the IAEA in Vienna, and also from the IAEA inspectors who visited the Iranian plants, that the technology that they've adopted for uranium enrichment is the same as the Pakistan program. We also know from intelligence communities, both in America and the UK, who had tracked some of the deals, that the meetings were held in Dubai, and we know what kind of centrifuges were offered and roughly what was paid and the methods of transport for that. And so there is a very clear idea of the genesis of the Iranian project. And of course, one should add that the Iranians claim that all of this was simply for creating energy rather than for creating a weapons program. And that, of course, the European project way back that Khan worked for also was looking at creating energy and not for weapons programs. It was the Pakistanis who took the technology and modified it in order to enrich uranium to levels at which it was sufficient to weaponize a nuclear device. So the position we have now is that Iran has taken the Pakistan technology, modified itself, and the information that we have from the IAEA, the best guess is, looking at the rate at which the equipment works and the time taken, is that they're still many, many years off being able to weaponize uranium. And the equipment is incredibly sensitive. One greasy thumbprint on a centrifuge spinning at 72,000 revolutions a minute is enough to send the machine off kilter, making the rotors warp and twist and bend and effectively shattering the entire centrifugal plant.
But what you're describing here is the United States supporting Pakistan, looking the other way as Pakistan develops and then sells nuclear technology. And then the United States turning around again and threatening to bomb Iran after Iran is sold nuclear technology and uses it, sold by Pakistan, the country that we've been supporting. That picture that you're painting is a very odd picture.
I think the picture that we're facing today is even more alarming and inexplicable in a way. I mean, London and Washington are today backing a military dictator who has instituted martial law in his country, has started putting civilians in front of military courts, who is accusing people of treason if they go out on the streets to protest, who claims that he's fighting the war on terror by rounding up the country's entire judiciary, who has suspended the constitution, now claims that he's going to hold free and fair elections under emergency powers in January. I mean, this is supposedly one of the West's, this is the West's most significant ally in the war on terror in South Asia. And yet we see very, very limited and soft responses both from London and Washington to what is happening in today's Pakistan. And this is the legacy of the long-term relationship with Pakistan. So I think what's happened in the past should not really be surprising, because what's actually happening today on the streets of Pakistan and the responses from Washington and London have been extraordinary.
My guests are journalists Adrian Levy and Catherine Scott Clark. Their new book, Deception, says the U.S. allowed Pakistan to acquire and sell nuclear technology. What do you think that the Bush administration and the British government have in terms of options for dealing with Musharraf now?
I think options are very limited. I think one thing we can see from 2001 is that our influence over the Pakistan military has been insignificant. They have their own agenda, their own philosophy, their own series of strategic goals, and they have set out to pursue those, regardless of the money that pours in the sense that, for example, Pakistan wants to see a conservative Pashtun administration raised in Kabul. They are hostile to the pro-Western, pro-Indian Hamid Karzai, and so it's in their interest to make the border areas between their two countries bubble and boil. It's in their interest to see attacks increasing on NATO forces to destabilize Karzai. And yet, somehow there's been no consideration that their strategic goals and our strategic goals might not actually marry up. One thing is for certain, if we cut aid to Musharraf and to the military and redirected that to targeted humanitarian responses, that would have a devastating effect. He's very much kept in power by the leverage he can call on from the West, the hard cash that comes in. And that's what keeps the other generals around him from cannibalizing him.
What are a couple of the possible scenarios you see playing out now in Pakistan? Like, how do you think this crisis might resolve?
I think there are two possibilities at the moment. The military itself is a vastly rich consortium of generals who are businessmen as well. They control around 12% of all Pakistan real estate. They've got a turnover of around $10 billion a year, the same as a good-sized European bank. And they also cannot afford this kind of instability, both politically, strategically, and commercially. And there is a lot of talk coming out of Rawalpindi in Islamabad, where the military are based, of replacing Musharraf with the acting chief of the army staff, a man called General Kiani, who was formerly the head of the intelligence service, a man who led the negotiations with Bhutto over the last year to 18 months, who reached out to try and bring her together with Musharraf. So one thing we should expect, possibly, is an internal reorganization of the military, whereby Musharraf may well be moved into some kind of ceremonial role, and Kiani will take over the day-to-day running of Pakistan.
There's definitely a sense coming out of the Pakistan military now that Musharraf is going really out on a limb on his own, and that the Pakistan army can't follow him because it will never be able to rescue its reputation if it sticks with Musharraf's extreme position in recent days. So very much there is a call for Kiani to take over, and he's seen very much as a moderate. He was partially educated at a military college in the States. He's seen as definitely an heir who would be acceptable to the West. So I think that is definitely a strong possibility of something that we might well see in the next few weeks.
You said there's two possible scenarios that you were thinking about. What's the other?
The second is a terrible period of deadlock. We're seeing the tightening up of the state of emergency in Pakistan, and talk from Musharraf of this state of emergency running all the way through to the election, which may now be January 9th or the middle of January. Now, effectively, that means that this election will be null and void, because there'll be no freedom to canvass. There'll be no ability to operate as political parties. Already thousands of activists have been rounded up. And if that situation prevails, I actually think that we may well be seeing a terrible showdown between the military and the people for the first time in Pakistan on this scale. And what we're talking about here, and I think it's mischaracterized sometimes, is the middle classes, largely speaking, who are backing the campaign for the restoration of democracy. It's not just lawyers, it's teachers, it is bankers, it is architects, it is the people who are sitting around in homes in Karachi and Lahore having conversations like we're having now, you know, who are used to previously a free press, to watching CNN and the BBC on their newly supplied cable news services, who are just alienated from the West support of a dictatorship and basically won't stand for it anymore. Now, if this movement picks up even more momentum, you know, this could well make the elections in themselves inoperable. You know, it's a slow-moving car crash.
Well, one more question. What would the United States stand to lose if Musharraf was kicked out or left on his own volition, and something much more closer to a real democracy evolved?
Well, I think a falsehood has occurred here, whereby for the last 7 years we've all been told that Musharraf is necessary, that the military is the largest stable force in Pakistan, and because Pakistan is genuinely so essential as an ally in the war on terror, that it's Musharraf or nothing. But the problem here has been that his agenda is contrary to the agenda of the West, and it's very much been Musharraf manipulating the conservative Islamist factions in Pakistan. And so, in fact, you know, some blue sky thinking here, which would actually aim to wrestle power back from the military, to stop propping them up, and actually to go about the less headline-grabbing, messy business of building democracy in Pakistan, might give us all much more long-term security vis-a-vis this country. I think already we had a forum talking to previous ambassadors like Wendy Chamberlain, who was very much for the end of big-ticket items being sent to the Pakistan military. Other great thinkers within the State Department previously, people like Teresita Schaefer and her husband Howard Schaefer, one now at Georgetown, the other at CSIS, both who rose to Assistant Secretary of State level and served ambassadorially, are all suggesting the same thing. You know, stop giving the military all the power, wrestle the cash away, make targeted aid that is not opaque, that we can see it achieving results. Otherwise, you know, if this continues with the Pentagon stepping in and crowding out the voices from the State Department, we may well see an insufferable situation which leads to an explosion in Pakistan, one we cannot afford to happen.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Adrian Levy and Catherine Scott Clark are the authors of the new book Deception, Pakistan, the United States, and the Secret Trade in Nuclear Weapons. They're senior correspondents for The Guardian.